We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Dave Collum, professor of organic chemistry at Cornell. How are you today, Dave?
I'm good. And you?
I'm good. Good to have you back and to chat. It's always always interesting to get to speak with you.
The faces are getting familiar. It's like, I once realized that having a friend doesn't necessarily mean that you've ever met them.
Well, that seems no more pertinent than in the last 2 years here, right?
Right. But something about you don't have to be sitting in the same room, right?
Well, exactly to your point there, Dave. I was listening to a podcast yesterday, and they were telling me a story about. You know, it did feel like telling me a story. They were telling a story about Theranos and knowing that. You know, we had this conversation coming up today. It made me think of you, and it made me wonder if your background as a scientist helps you see through the BS when you look at any of these, you know, mega market cap companies like that.
There are times. What helps me see through the BS is that I can see the BS in science, both with respect to politicization of science, which is getting to be a chronic problem, as well as scientists who all are trying to, in the most sincere way possible, trying to get it right, still getting it wrong. And so I'm in a complex area of chemistry, and when we started, it seemed to be somewhat intractable. I had people saying it was not tractable. I had people saying, thinking they already understood it. And one of the things that came out of it was that despite what we did know, none of it held up very well. And so when I look at economists, central bankers saying that they know something, I don't think so. And so it's my superpower is to call bullshit on anyone, no matter how qualified they seem to be.
Absolutely. It seems like, now again, more than ever, it seems like you can find any piece of data to support either side of wherever you want to stand, right?
It's a horrifying thing, actually. So again, I'm writing this big document, and the title of it is going to be, I think, Crisis of Authorities. And it's a double entendre. One is that we don't have authorities we can trust now. And I thought we did. There were some obvious ones. I wouldn't trust the CIA, right? I think they're up to no good a lot of times. But 2 years ago, I would have said the CDC or the FDA were totally credible. And I've got a burn it to the ground process in my head right now on those two. And we go through the various lockdown debates, and it just seems like everyone's lying. And there are people trying to get it right. They're getting kicked off social media. And so it's a pretty strange thing. So the other crisis of authority is not only we don't have authorities that we can turn to and say, tell us what's happening, but we also have authorities who are being authoritarian. And so it's a real problem now.
So Dave, how do we get away from that though? You spoke about the politicization of science, and it seems that there are people that think that changing your opinion on something almost seems like a weakness now. So how do we get back to a place where we can have rational discourse and have a set of facts that we can speak about that are, on the same playing field?
I don't think people do think changing your opinion is a weakness. I think people are, or at least I am, I shouldn't speak for people. I'm perturbed by the fact that there are opinions that are not accepted. That not just not believed. I have no problem not being believed. My God, I raised teenagers, right? But I have trouble with what I call the age of narratives, where there's a narrative, whether it's the Federal Reserve, whether it's, we have to print our way out of everything, that you can speak out against without anyone oppressing you, although I'm not sure those days aren't numbered. So at some point, are you going to get kicked off social media if you're posting stuff about the Fed being a bunch of boneheads? And I've heard people say, no question, those days are coming. But a great example is COVID, right? You can be ostracized to the point you're kicked off Twitter, you're kicked off Facebook, you're kicked off all the out of the town square, which is what they represent, for simply expressing an idea that goes against the narrative, which is perceived by people of great power and importance, well, great power, to be the only acceptable narrative. And the pejorative I keep turning to, my wife says, don't go there, it's too dark. I keep calling them Nazis. Nazis is a specific kind of authoritarian, but authoritarian sounds so watered down to me. So Nazi seems like the appropriate term. Let's call it the Nazi 2.0, right? New kind of Nazi. Mm-hmm. And I'm militantly angry at those guys. And I just don't know what we're supposed to do. I at some level have this concern that that this path was a foregone conclusion with the arrival of the digital world. That as I like to say, you know, when I read 1984, it was fiction because you couldn't fathom how they could monitor everybody. And then the internet goes live and the digital world arrives. Now you go, okay, that part's easy now. Mm-hmm. So then the question is, can you give that kind of power? Can you put that kind of power out into the world and not have someone commandeer it and exploit it? And the answer is probably not. And so I don't know. It's a weird situation.
So since your year end in review kind of thing that you've titled, you know, this crisis of authority, we've already spoken this year a lot about inflation. So when we get this loss of confidence from the general public in the authorities that are at the moment, do you think that is part of the road towards a hyperinflationary situation?
You know, I always get nervous about hyperinflationary. High inflation versus hyper, there's what a chemist would call a phase change. Mm-hmm. High inflation is when inflation expectations are running, I think. And I think that really is important. And you always used to hear the Fed talk about inflation expectations because they used it as evidence that everything was fine. Once the inflationary mindset gets into society's DNA, once you are a contractor and you're bidding to build a house 2 years from now, and you go, I have to tack on 15% on the cost of labor, on the cost of materials, or I can't bid the job. Mm-hmm. It's gotten into the DNA. And so if you are a union, you're negotiating a new contract, you're not going to accept a 2% raise now. And it's not whether or not inflation is running hot or not. You have to assume it is. It's gotten into the DNA. So one could argue that it's caused by the supply shocks of this era, which is not a crazy argument, but I would argue that maybe that was a trigger more than a cause. And so someone lit a match in a room full of natural gas and we've blown up the house. I don't see how you unwind the inflation expectations now without a Volcker-like moment. I think we're there. And meanwhile, you watch the Federal Reserve and they look like a bunch of assholes. They look like Stephen Roach wrote a great article earlier this year saying that Powell's making exactly the same mistake that Arthur Burns made in the 70s. He kept saying, inflation's transitory. And he'd make up all these excuses for why it's transitory. I see nothing in this inflation as transitory. Now, I correct it. When lumber shot up threefold, that's transitory. But it's not going to regress back to up 2%. Mm-hmm. And the Fed uses this garble language where they like to talk about, and they're correct in distinguishing. So if lumber goes up 15% in a sustainable way, but then starts climbing at 2% after that, then the price was sticky, but the inflation was not. So we're going to pay that extra 15%. It's going to hurt, but it was a one-off, you know, in your shorts hit. But then we'll go back to normal. But if it doesn't regress back, then the inflation is still high. And if it doesn't, if the rate of change doesn't change. So Powell got asked that and he garbled the answer. And everyone criticized him for making no sense. He made sense. He was tripping over his tongue trying to not make headlines. But he basically said that the prices were sticky, but the inflation is not. And that's a valid hypothesis, but that's not what I'm seeing in the mindset of the populace now. Now, hyperinflation is when the populace flat out loses faith in the currency itself. And I don't see us getting there yet. I have no trouble imagining us getting there. If Congress keeps passing multi-trillion dollar bills, we could get there. Mm-hmm. But I think that requires some really fundamental change in people's thinking, where it's get me out of cash at any cost. And that's when, you know, the Weimar Germany, when the husbands would deliver their pay to the wives standing at the gate so they could run out and buy groceries before the groceries went up, right? That sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That's a loss in faith in the currency, period. The Weimar guys were happy as clams. They were so proud of how many Deutschmarks they could print per day. And they thought somehow that was a win. And they thought the inflation was actually being caused by the fact that there was demand for Deutschmarks. So their job is to provide Deutschmarks. Or it's another name, Rentenmark or something. I can't keep these straight. It's in Germany. I don't know, whatever. But their currency, German currency. Mm-hmm. So you know, hyperinflation could come, but it's not here yet.
And it just goes... It just goes to show that there's so many factors to look at. You can't point at one thing or another. You know, if velocity picks up, all of a sudden we're going to get X. You know, there it's not a binary equation, really.
So I'm going to ask you a question. Why do you think gold and silver are not yet responding?
Well, I think there are so many different reasons for that that you could point to. I think the biggest part of it is that there could be these large firms that still believe the transitory narrative. And I also think that cryptocurrency has taken away some of the capital flow towards something that has a, let's say, a 5,000 year tradition of being money. Right. You know, I was watching another video this morning and they were pointing out that gold isn't actually necessarily the best inflation hedge. It can be really beneficial in deflation, and hyperinflation, but that grinding 2% inflation that we've always seen, it's not necessarily good at accounting for that. Over time,
although since early 70s, it's up 7.5% a year. So in that sense, it's done that. But the analogy I like is that equities and a shovel and a bulldozer both move dirt, but they serve very different purposes. Mm-hmm. Equities and gold hedge inflation, but they serve very different purposes. So I think the gold potentially takes off. I think the cannibalization by the cryptos of the gold demand is very real. And it leads to an interesting hypothesis. If cryptos start taking a beating for some reason, I see several reasons why without declaring the crypto guys nuts. I don't have to, but they're facing a Tether problem. They haven't yet gone through a credit crisis. So the cryptos were either non-existent or in their very infancy the last time we had a real credit problem. So if we end up with a deflationary like stretch, you know, disinflationary like stretch where assets start selling, the cryptos could be super leveraged. I know there's some weird leveraging going on, and they're gonna have to get through that. And they haven't yet faced the authorities attempting to take them down. And mm-hmm. You make a case they're not going to. I can see why people make that case. If crypto starts getting beaten up, it might show an interesting inverse correlation with gold. That would be, and I'm not rooting against the cryptos because they share the same concerns as me. Do you think there are forces pushing gold down or not? It's you know, I'm a conspiracy guy. I think men and women conspire. But I don't know whether anyone gives a damn enough about gold to push it down beyond just traders, right? There's no question guys at JP Morgan and Goldman and stuff are can see the bid stack and ram it down and then bid it up. And they're just basically molesting us constantly. But that's not price suppression. That's just hijinks.
Well, and that's illegal. That's a really important point, Dave. Is, you know, I've spoken to many guests on the show about the manipulation. Some guys for, some guys against, but I think that's the important part of it, I think, is that we need to have a nuanced discussion about what type of manipulation we're talking about. Are we talking about long-term price suppression? Are we talking about spoofing in the markets? Are we talking about, you know, taking futures demand off? There's so many different ways that could be played out. And I tend to agree with you. I don't know that anybody necessarily gives, you know, that much credit towards gold to put that much effort into it.
I do think, however, the so-called paper gold market did the same thing at some level that the cryptos did, where it produced a demand everywhere but physical. Mm-hmm. And so I think that by putting out, you know, gold, and I do not believe, for example, that GLD has gold. I do not believe SLB has gold. I think it's a fractional reserve mechanism at play. I read the prospectus when it first came out, and I go, this is bullshit. Mm-hmm. This is not Central Fund of Canada. They don't get audited. They don't get inventory. Basically, the prospectus said could be here, could be there, could be anywhere. Don't worry about it. That's what the prospectus
And then they can come back, you know, in the middle of the night and change the prospectus to say that, you know, we could take more time than we have in the past
or pay you in dollars or whatever. Yeah. Exactly. And you know, I had a friend who tried to pry $60 million worth of gold out of GLD, and he hired a team of lawyers to try to pry $60 million. Now, why didn't just go buy gold? I don't know, except for maybe he wanted to test GLD. You read the prospectus, there's nothing in there that says he gets to pry gold out of GLD. Mm-hmm. There's certain, the so-called bullion banks or something, who supposedly do. Again, if it's fractional reserve, that's a silly idea. But there's nothing there that says you can convert your GLD into gold. I don't even understand, when they talk about the amount of gold in GLD, I don't even understand the dynamics of that. Why isn't GLD just like a closed-end fund that reflects, you know, and I guess the arbitrage mechanism where if it gets a little above, in theory, you buy gold. If it gets a little below, in theory, you sell gold. Yeah, that sort of thing, or vice versa. But I wouldn't trust GLD. I wouldn't trust SLB. I would trust the Sprott funds. I've had Central Fund of Canada since 99. I recently bought some PSLV this year, which I've got a lot of silver anyways, but I went longer. I went longer sort of in support of the silver squeeze. And I think those guys have the gold, the silver and gold and whatever, and uranium now. I actually tried to buy the uranium and my brokerage wouldn't let me do it.
Well, hopefully, you know, coming, I believe it's at some point next year, they're looking at doing an NYSE listing. So that should be very beneficial for
SPUT. By then it'll be bid up, right? By the time it goes public, it'll be bid up. I just decided to go with a boutique uranium equity investing firm. Mm-hmm. They can also probably buy URA. So my guess is I do own URA. That's my guess. Mm-hmm. And uranium is a very long-term bet. So that's a bet that that the Japanese are going to shake off Fukushima, that Macron is going to follow through and build more nuke plants, that the green movement, which I consider to be scientifically probably wrong. I you can legislate all the green shit you want, but I don't think solar and wind can replace fossil fuels. I just don't think they can do it. And I've been trying to find an article that definitively says, Dave, you're right, or Dave, you're wrong. I haven't been able to find it. I can find propaganda. But I believe fossil fuels are here to stay. And I believe that at some point we're going to go to uranium. And I have this quirky thesis that, you know, you're hearing about the fossil fuel shortages in Europe. And you hear some dire stories about people freezing to death in Europe this winter and stuff like that. And I've heard rumors the US and this and that. In an age of narratives where we keep getting our chain yanked by the authorities, now we got to mask up, we got to vaccinate. And that whole story is both got some facts and filled with crap. Then the question I would add is, if you wanted to sell uranium to the masses, how would you do it? Well, what you would do is you would have a crisis. You would trigger a crisis. And so by the end of this winter, we could have the average American saying, just give me a vaccine and nuclear power. That's all I want. I want to feel safe again, right? And so I think you could bring nukes back, but you could bring them back aggressively if you show the world what it's like to not have power.
That's a great point, Dave. And you know, if how deeply have you looked at the uranium supply side of the story? Do you think that there is plenty of supply that can come online, you know, at $50?
I haven't. I'm using what's called borrowed knowledge. We all live on borrowed knowledge. Borrowed knowledge is not knowledge you borrow from someone else.
Chauffeur knowledge, right?
Yeah.
Have you heard that analogy?
I've not heard that analogy, but I bet it's the same. And at some point, if you read enough sources, it starts becoming real knowledge, I think. But it certainly is borrowed. And so my best source is some guy like Rick Rule telling me things, right? And so I don't have the bandwidth to start digging into uranium supplies. At one point, I thought, you know, the rare earth metal shortage was an issue. Mm-hmm. And I found myself sitting in a town in Germany having dinner with the mayor of the town and the CEO of Chemetall, which is a mining company. And I asked him, I said, what about this? He said, no, that's just at the current pricing that's being set by China, no one can compete. He said, there's plenty. He said, just not at these prices. Now, here's where it gets interesting. By the time the prices go up and you realize, oh, now it's priced to be mined elsewhere, you're 10 years away from having a mine. Mm-hmm. And so it's not like you just open a mine the way you open a convenience store where the traffic is now running high, right? It's not that easy. And so I'm investing in companies like Rio Tinto and things like that. I think pre-existing mining operations look like a pretty good bet to me right now, even though if the market gets clobbered the way I think it's going to be, I'm going to get hurt too. So I have a lot of cash, a lot of gold, a lot of silver.
So what makes you so bullish on silver, Dave? Is it just the leverage to gold that
no. I talked to a guy from, wait a minute, who was it? It was, I think I was at a meeting and I think it was a guy who was working with Sprott and he was bearish on silver. And I'm thinking you should keep that to yourself given who you work for. And he was saying silver's losing its monetary metal status. So now it's just a commodity. Unlike gold, silver does not get recycled. You can't. It's in every electronic device. If we really are heading into the digital future, silver is going to follow it. And supposedly we're in deficit supply and that we're consuming reserves. And then you got Eric Sprott out there sucking it into PSLV. Here's a bearish scenario. What if, and I don't know how this would be triggered. What if all of a sudden Eric Sprott said, okay, I'm done. And liquidates PSLV and all that silver hits the market. Holy moly, right? So you'd hope that the idea is that PSLV is a one-directional bet, that once it's in there, you know, Central Fund of Canada, it's been locked in there for since 1964. So Eric's taking it off the market. What if there's a route back to the market? There could be a real bloodbath for the silver team. Mm-hmm. So I worry about that. Why am I bullish on silver? Because you can't, it's a non-recyclable metal. Even when we were doing photography, it was so recycled from the photography because it always came in exactly the same form. So when you develop the photograph, the rinsings had the silver in it. You put them in a drum and you shipped them back, and it was like a 99% recovery. So it wasn't even a consumer of silver. Photography was barely a consumer of silver. But now it's the digital world. Sucks up huge amounts of silver, solar panels suck up huge amounts, although sucking up less because they're getting better at using the silver more sparingly. And so it just seems like a good bet, right? It just seems like, I like the story. We all love narratives. I like the story. I did Wall Street Silver podcasts, a couple of them. I said, something happened to your silver squeezer, dudes. I got the feeling maybe there was a price suppression in that one. So imagine that you've got the Reddit team going nuts. They go, we're going to put the wood to silver. You could imagine powerful forces on Wall Street saying, we can't give them the win. So almost to the day the silver squeeze started, silver started getting pounded. Mm-hmm. And that seemed almost, maybe it's buy the rumor, sell the news, but it seemed too coincidental to me. So I got this feeling maybe they're saying, we got to show these guys who controls price.
That's a great point. And it also shows kind of the place in which you take it out of the market also matters, right?
Right. But there's only so much silver, right, coming out mm-hmm. into the market, and there's very few silver plays. So to the extent that silver goes into deficit and that you're getting it from mining other things, then the flow rate into the market is dictated by the mining of other things like copper and stuff like that. And that even the pure plays like Pan American Silver are supposedly at this point a gold mining operation, right? And so silver, it could be very hard to say we're going to ramp up silver because you go, okay, what are we going to do with all the damn copper then, right? So silver could go into serious price squeeze. Now, that would be fun. And if silver goes parabolic, if the Wall Street Reddit guys had pulled it off and it did an AMC, GME sort of moment, I would have sold into that. I was locked and loaded to sell into that. And what I might have done is, for example, sold into that and moved it over to gold, hoping that then I'd go back to silver after the Reddit team got their ass kicked.
Well, that's an interesting point about playing the ratios. I know I talked to Andrew Hosey. He is another YouTuber, and he kind of brought up the idea of switching back and forth from gold to silver at different ratios and showed the math behind it. And he made an really substantial amount of money theoretically by just playing the ratios over a 20-year period.
Yeah, I don't know why the ratio is considered to be a fundamental constant of nature, though. So mm-hmm. I get it. There's also the equity gold ratio, right? Mm-hmm. So when the Dow's expensive relative to gold, or when it's cheap relative to gold, but gold got the crap kicked out of it after reaching the 1900 high. The Dow gold ratio had dropped considerably. To really bottom out, it looked like there was another factor of four in it easily. When you look at a plot, it goes way down, but there's a factor of four left down in that bump. And so I was not going to sell. And then I got pounded, right? In a Dow gold ratio model, I got pounded. So I don't know what to do with the ratio idea. I think rearview mirror, you could say it worked. But that's not why I buy silver.
Absolutely. So, Dave, in that vein, why is platinum so attractive to you?
Because no one has discovered it yet. So if you look at all the various metals, they've all had their day in the sun and platinum hasn't. And then here's an internet moment. Some guy sent me an email, and he's just some guy who's smart. And he sent me some analyses of platinum miners. And it's a YouTube, and he had about 70 clicks. Right. This was not a viral YouTube. And he goes through the balance sheet with his cursor and saying, here's this and here's that. And here's their earnings from this year. And here's what's projected for next year. And platinum's, sitting at 1200 and this and that. And I'm going, this looks like a pretty good value analysis. And after watching a couple of his YouTubes, I said, yeah, the two plays appear to be Impala and Sabanye, I think it's called. And they pay dividends. They look like value plays. And they look like if Platinum took off, they would become super value plays, as in, you know, pay for the price of the shares in 2 years sort of value plays, right? And so I none of the stuff I bought this year was in volume. You know, Stan Druckenmiller talks about how, you know, if you really get a good idea, you got to be 200% into it. For every Stan Druckenmiller who made, you know, who doubled down on every on the thing, there's 1,000 Dave Collins who got crushed by the Druckenmiller truck. And so if somehow you think that you should imitate Stan Druckenmiller, you're out of your gourd. So I tiptoed into uranium and precious and other kinds of precious metals and stuff more this year, but it was like a 4% move. So to call me wildly bullish. On the other hand, I'm old enough and doing well enough that it looks like a lot of money. So that's the good news, right? Mm-hmm.
So Dave, you've said before that you've had, you know, three amazing decades and the last one has been poor, exactly as you were just talking about. So what right. were the bets that you took over those great decades? And do you think that there was something wrong with your choice in that last decade, or were there external factors that pushed it into that?
Well, there are definitely external factors. So the first decade was the 80s, and I couldn't care less about investing. Cornell put 10% of my equivalent of my salary into a retirement account, which is pretty generous. I was reading I had just bought a house, was cash poor, and was got into antiques simply because you could buy them cheaper than real furniture, which I now have great antiques, which went down in value. But I'm reading a USA article, and it says, are you putting enough into your retirement account? I'm thinking, well, I can put additional contributions, which I'm kind of not doing because I've got these other things happening. And they said, if you are not putting in enough, my dad had always coached me on save, 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 but I felt like I was doing what I should be doing at that point. But they said, put in 1% more. And then next year, put in another 1% more. And over the 80s, I got up to the full allocation of another 10%. And then at some point, I reached a net salary that put me into some sort of elite category that allowed me, and I don't know why, but it allowed me to put in another watt. And so it for quite a few years now, I've been putting in 30% of my gross into retirement. And that's a lot of savings. And so in any event, through the 80s, I was all long bonds until the crash. And when I was a kid, I liked the stock market. I used to talk to my dad at the table. I thought I was going to go to Wall Street, but then I completely lost the trail. And I'm sitting in the faculty lounge and somebody says, you know, Dave, you should have some equities. If you look at the history of equity performance, it's very good. So I said, oh, that's a good point. So I switched equities. So I'd been long bonds from 80 to 87. Crash occurs. I rolled the equities. Dumb luck. It was also methodical. It wasn't insane. I didn't do a one gigantic woof over. By the time I was mid-90s, I was heavily equities. And I was a tech bull, which means we're in a mania because I certainly wasn't qualified to be a tech bull. And I made, you know, 700-800% on WorldCom and got out, right? How many people can say that, right? I lived to fight another fight. I own Dell, wrote it all the way up. I own, you know, companies like Warner Lambert that were great. And so the 90s were nominally my best decade by far, huge returns in the 90s. And then by late 90s, July 1st of 98. I remember first or second, somewhere in there, very beginning of July, I had concluded the markets were nuts. And I'd started reading serious analyses where the guy's going, you know, this is frothy shit now. And so I rolled half my mutual funds into cash back into the fixed income stuff. And then we went right into the Asian crisis. I'm going, you're half genius, half idiot. I don't know which. And I decided that if the markets came back, that I would get the rest out. And they came back, and by mid-90s, I had exited everything, right down to the last share of equity exposure. And I don't know who was most convincing. It was kind of a James Grant, Bill Fleckenstein sales pitch, but I moved into gold, and I moved into a short fund. Not huge position of short fund, but quite a bit of gold. I was buying gold at 270 to 290. Right. That was at the very beginning. And in fact, it went down for about a year before it went up. Meanwhile, the NASDAQ was still going up. And so I'm feeling like a complete idiot. But in retrospect, it worked really well. And then mm-hmm. I was afraid of inflation. When you grow up in the 70s, it's now scar tissue, right? You're afraid of inflation. And I started buying energy in 01. And I tried to play the commodities. I couldn't find a way to play them. In fact, I had a long conversation with Jimmy Rogers' partner in the Rogers Commodity Fund, a guy named Clyde Harrison. I talked to the guy who was one of the market makers. I spent probably 2 or 3 hours chatting about it. Said, nope, this is not for me. It was all based on options. I didn't like it. So I started buying Fidelity, you know, energy funds, just, you know, their energy fund, their natural gas fund, things like that. And as a consequence, in nominal dollars, it was not as good. The decade of the noughts was not as good as the 90s for me. But on a relative basis to the rest of society, where anyone listening who was in equities will remember, it was horrifying, right? The noughts were horrifying. You went from the dot-com bubble to the dregs of the 09 crisis. That was a bad decade. I compounded 13%. Then what happened was that at the bottom of the 08-09 crisis, which I saw coming, I'm on paper. I called it an 02. You say, well, you're wrong. But I mean, I called the collapse of the banking system an 02. And eyewitnesses. And so when it showed up March of 07, I could hear the cracking noises, and they weren't audible to most people, but there was this thing called a market ABX index, which was a derivatives index, which was basically, you know, some sort of hedges against mortgage-backed securities or something, started to tank, and it was very quietly started to go down. Someone knew something. So I actually said to my class, I think the banking system's about to collapse. In March of 07, 2 years later, I had the same group in a senior honors thesis class. And we're in the throes of the disaster. And on the first day, I said, "Did I tell you guys in class tomorrow the banking system was going to collapse?" They said, "Yes, you did. We're your witness." And I said, "Did any of your economics profs tell you?" And they said, "No." And I said, "What are those assholes paid for? Right? What'd they miss?" My first guest lecture was an honors thesis class. I had guest lecture. My first guest lecture was the CEO of Morgan Stanley Bank, who came in and talked about the crisis. And he had cut his teeth on mortgage-backed securities as a young punk. And he was, at one point, had a fund that was leveraged 2 million-fold.
Wow.
He had no assets backing the leverage, just none. Basically,
unreal.
You know, money in the coffee can. And he it was 2 hours of just incredible stories about what was happening on Wall Street. So in any event, I was positive we had more damage coming. So out of sheer greed, I was not a heavy buyer in 09. And out of greed, I was not a buyer. I said, look, there's going to be a bounce just like in 1930, 31, but we are going to plumb a low that is going to be brutal. And the Fed made sure it never came. No, let me rephrase it. The Fed made sure it hasn't come yet. And so I missed it. And so I had a little bit of equity exposure, but not much. And the gold was okay. But I think I probably tied inflation for the last decade while everyone else is getting steak and rich. Mm-hmm. I do believe that the day of reckoning is coming. And even though COVID, thermonuclear warhead COVID, didn't blow up the damn market, inflation, I think, eventually will. And then I think we're looking at a conservative 60% correction, pessimistic 80, 85. and it will destroy boomers. It will be the last time a generation had an attitude adjustment that really, really, really changed people's views of investing was in the 67 to 81 bear market, where they lost 75% inflation adjusted over 14 years, which means a third of your investing life. And they came out of that in 81 so traumatized about equities that no one would buy them at the precise moment that buying them was a brilliant thing to do.
And that attitude adjustment that you're mentioning there, that's one of the two qualities of a true correction to you, right?
Yeah, I said a correction has two requirements. One is a big price change, and the second is an affiliated attitude adjustment. And then I presented to Twitter the question, when was our last correction? And of course, I got a bunch of stupid answers like, oh, March of 2020. And I go, please explain to me the attitude that got changed. Mm-hmm. We got hit with a thermonuclear warhead and you still made a ton of money that year. That changed. The only thing that does reinforce the attitude that you always, always hang on and you always buy the dips and you always are going to make money. The average investor, according to polls, thinks you're going to make 17% a year. Buffett says that back in 99, said, if you think you can sustainably make about 4%, you're dreaming. You're dreaming. Because it tracks the economy. Mm-hmm. That's it. You know, if equity prices don't track the economy, what the hell do they represent? Mm-hmm. And so we're sitting at valuations that are at all-time highs, 20, 25 metrics. Some of them are not quite all-time highs. Others are way off the chart all-time highs. And so if you average them, we're at all-time highs. We've got companies that can't even pay the interest payments on their debt with interest payments almost zero. We've never been in this situation before. We've got huge corporate leverage. The crisis of 2020, for the first time ever, corporate debt went up, not down, during what they call a recession. I wouldn't even call it a recession. I'd call it a fuck up. And so we've corrected nothing. And if you go back to the dot-com bubble, it could have adjusted attitudes, but didn't. It just out of those silly gooses who bought pets.com, right? Mm-hmm. Don't do that. Blah, of course not. You go back to 87, bad joke. 87 taught us the Fed will save us. That was the inaugural. That was the debutante party of Fed intervention. Mm-hmm. And so you go back to 67 and 81. That's when we learned that investing is dangerous.
So I've heard you say before that you hate the P to E ratio. So how do you try and analyze some of these companies and what they're worth, Dave?
Well, so I have bought some stuff this year, and if there's something I can do with picking up a trend that 10 years from now should have made me money, I might have that ability. I certainly am not a bean counting balance sheet analyzer. But I have some basic ideas right now that I think are important. You never know what's under the surface. You could be buying Theranos, right? You just don't know. Unless you're Jim Chanos and you can really lift up the hood and really analyze the company, and I can't. But I don't want companies now that have debt. And if they have a little bit of debt, I'm okay. As long as I look at their revenues, I say they can knock that debt out of there. If interest rates go up, they can just knock it out of there. And mm-hmm. and if their revenue, if their debt is three times revenues, I got a big problem with that. Because their revenues may not hold up. And that's just too much debt. So I want to see cash on the balance sheet, net cash. That's what I really want to see. And there are companies out there have it. I want PE is fine, but I want to see a dividend. I want to see a dividend where the payout ratio is a decently low percentage. So the dividend is not like Exxon was a buy signal last year when it got kicked out of the Dow. But Exxon's dividend was measurably higher than its cash flow. And now I know energy was a mess, but I'm going, I still don't like that. And so I've been investing in things where their dividend looks totally sustainable, barring some unforeseeable event by me. And Michael Burry said something 20 years ago that someone found and posted. He said, you know, your default setting on an investment should be that in the worst case scenario that you get your ass kicked, you just hang on to it. And what I'll tell you is that doesn't describe Netflix. It doesn't describe a lot of the companies. It doesn't describe Tesla. To me, Tesla is an absurdity, just a complete. I just watched another Tesla fire. When are they going to ban Tesla cars, right? When you have a fire that takes 24 hours to put out that stops traffic for 24 hours because you had a fender bender, why is that car on the road? All right, we can't afford to have highways filled with cars that are self-igniting. It just doesn't make sense. So at some point, Tesla's going to go from worth a fortune to nothing. It's going to get bought out by someone who knows how to make cars. And so I like Netflix. Netflix is a huge drain because it has to create new content. It finally made a profit in 2020 because they didn't have to make new content. They couldn't. And everyone sat around watching Netflix. And so they finally had no capex and profits. And so they had net profits. But they're burning money. They are a cash-burning machine under normal circumstances. So if Netflix, which is worth, I don't know, something like $500 billion, it's some ridiculous number. I look at Netflix, I go to watch something, I think it sucks. I mean, I think it's like HBO. Would you put $500 billion on HBO? No. And so if Netflix dropped by 99%, right? You'd still own a company that loses money. Mm-hmm. How do you value that company? I don't. There's no price that's going to get them to make money.
So on the other side of the value spectrum, Dave, what do you think we need for gold miners to be recognized as money-making companies? And maybe talk to us a bit about the shift you've seen in them since you started looking at them.
Well, gold miners I hated. I hated them because they never seemed to make money. I know you can go back to homestake mining in the 30s, blah, blah, blah. But gold went from 256 to 1900 back to 12. And the gold miners that had a great run gave it all back. And at no point did they pay good dividends or anything. They just failed. And they failed due to bad management. They couldn't exploit the opportunity. Maybe what they did is they put into place a bunch of mining operations. Then the price of gold went down and then somehow they had to board it up. Maybe now they're ready because they now have put in the capex in the previous bull to be ready for the next bull. Maybe that. But every time someone said gold miners are cheap, it was always an optionality argument. It was always like they're cheap because they have gold in the ground and gold's going to go up and this is going to be great. I go, look, dude, I live on a lake. I am not a fishery. All my fish are in the lake. I could sell bass for who knows how much a pound, but I still got to get them out of there somehow. I don't want to hear about some gold miner that's sitting on top of gold. I want to hear a gold miner that goes in there, gets the gold, gets it out, sells it, makes money and pays a dividend. And that was non-existent. And then I'd ignore gold miners for a very long time. And then I'd hear someone say they're cheap, and I go, yeah, optionality cheap. And then one day Fred Hickey's giving a podcast, and he says they're cheap, and I go, here comes the optionality argument. And they start citing the numbers. I go, whoa, wait, that is cheap. And so I started looking them up. Companies like Kirkland Lake and stuff, low PE. Again, I don't trust E. So how do you like PE? But they have cash on the balance sheet. They have a dividend. They're making money now at the price of gold. Now it's not optionality. If Kirkland Lake cuts in half, presumably that dividend will go percentage wise up. I can buy some more. It's a revenue stream which I can't get off of treasuries. I can't get off of corporate bonds. I don't dare buy a corporate bond. So that's a Michael Berry if you have to hold it. And so if I don't care if no one discovers gold miners, they are a revenue stream at this point. And they will discover it if they sustainably produce earnings, right? If they sustainably pay out dividends. And so that's why I like the gold miners now. Finally, after 20 years of looking down my nose at them, I like them.
Mm-hmm. But Dave, what's the difference between a dividend-based investing system and a capital gains-based investing system? And why have we seen this shift?
There's a guy named Ed McQuarrie. who's relatively obscure, I think, maybe it's not fair, maybe he's not obscure, but an economist at UC Irvine who's been writing about this. And one of his pet peeves is Jeremy Siegel. And so he hammers Siegel for cherry picking his windows and timeframes and analyses. Ed has gone back 200 years and looked at stocks versus bonds. The reason it warms my heart is I've always had made the assertion that the free market will arbitrage away an advantage of one investment over the other. And they say, and equities always return more than bonds because equities have risk. And I go, well, dude, the reason they always return more than stocks return more than bonds is because every once in a while they don't. And then the risk shows up. And then all of a sudden you get your ass kicked. And if a market's pricing them correctly, the equities will return more than bonds for periods of time, and they get their ass kicked. Well, Ed published a paper this year, or uploaded a paper, or sent me a paper. How's that? For all I know, it's not out there. In which he looked at the last 200 years and said equities and bonds tie each other, which is what a free market should do. If something can earn 15% for 5 years in a row and then lose 30 or 40 or 50 for the next couple, it should be priced accordingly. And he said equities and bonds tie, with the exception of the 40 years following World War II, where the bond market got its ass kicked in the post-war financially repressing period, where we were not only economically burning down the debt, but we were making the savers pay off the debt by taking negative yields. And so the bond markets got crushed. So there's one window that makes that equity bond argument valid. The equities do better than bonds. If you take that out, they don't. So then the question is, what else did he tell us? Well, he noticed that over the 20th century, we migrated from mostly dividends and small amounts of capital gain. All you have to do is look at the Dow from 1900 to 1940. It's a great plot, actually. I can send it to you. Where it's drifting along, just barely rising. And then in the 20s, it takes off. The 29 hits the peak, comes back down, tanks like a son of a bitch, then rises back up and takes off again. And you can draw a line right through the boom bust. And it's this beautifully, gently rising curve. And so what you can see through the lens of the equity market, that the Great Depression was just a correction from the 1920s credit-based boom. Now, equities don't dictate economies, at least not directly, but you can see it perfectly. You can see that if you looked at equities in 1900 and 1940, they look priced correctly. It's just that stupid two decades in the middle where they went first too high and then too low. And so over the 20th century, though, we migrated from 4% dividends, very little capital gains. Don't forget 4%. Warren Buffett's 4%, very little capital gains, to all capital gains are very little dividends. And I don't know what drove that. It's conceivable the tax structure drove it. It's conceivable corporate chieftains getting compensated based on equity price drove it, right? We know that drill. When they passed a law how you can't pay CEOs more than a certain amount, they said, okay, then we'll compensate them in other ways. And so options and things like that. So all of a sudden, well, a person who owns a ton of options sure as hell is not going to pay a dividend. Because the day your dividends gets paid, your share price goes down proportionate to the dividend. So if you take all your profits and turn them into dividends, the option holder gets nothing. And so the option holders also making the calls are going to let capital gains run the show. Mm-hmm. That is an argument for why valuation should have risen at some level. But right now they've risen to the point where they're priced to return about maybe 2% a year, sustainably in the sense over the next 50, something like that. The path to that 2% is likely to be much more dramatic. I think at some point we're going to get the Felder-Husman negative 6% for 10 years sort of thing. But then it'll be a great buying opportunity. That'll be 67, 81 time to buy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to change your attitude and kind of try and get some perspective and look at it for what it is.
The horror story is that it'll take, if it takes a dozen or 15 years, I will be 80 years old. And am I really going to be buying dips at 80?
Yeah. No. That's the last thing you're going to be worried about.
I might not be an equity buyer in a serious way from here on out. Mm-hmm.
So, Dave, I know you've spent a lot of time this year thinking and trying, thinking about and trying to understand China a bit more. And I spoke with another guest last week about the risks that they pose from, let's say, a military standpoint, a slowing export standpoint.
So who is that? Who's the guest?
Simon Hunt.
Oh, yeah. I like Simon Hunt.
So we were talking about, you know, the risks that China poses from a military standpoint, a slowing export standpoint, and a debt bubble standpoint. So which of those risks are most prescient to you?
So the debt bubble is emblematically the Evergrande story, right? I've paid almost no attention to that story for the simple reason they talk about Evergrande. What is it? 300, 400 billion, something like that. I see no evidence from our experience in the West that China can't just print that away. And so if they say, well, it's the Lehman crisis, I go, well, we printed that away. So it's hard for me to get bent out of shape. Now, China has a demographic problem. They're an aging population, supposedly, which I've always underestimated demographics. If someone had told me, by the way, the boomers are going to change investing and going to change valuation stuff in a very big way because they're going to hit stride, maximum productivity, would have been time to go all in equities just on a demographic argument. China, most of the world is now on the opposite side of the demographic slope. China's military issues, I think, are profound just because it's black swans all. We could have a flock of black swans hit us from that. So I heard someone speculate the other day on AM radio that everyone's saying, oh, China's not going to move on Taiwan until, and he said, you know, he said, some people are saying until after the Olympics. I go, that's real soon. Right. They didn't say until, you know, 6 years from now or 10 years from now. They said after the Olympics. But he said, I'm not sure they'll wait. He said, I'm not sure they'll follow the Russian model of, like, you know, post Sochi Olympics where they moved on, what, Ukraine or something. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, shit. And I don't know what the appropriate response is. So if China moves on Taiwan, do we get into it with them? If we don't, do we pay a profound price as the former superpower? Do we? We've got Japan and Taiwan staring at us going, holy shit, the United States looks like they are not a dependable ally now. They've got a president who's demented, and you can take that as a partisan statement, but it's not. It's a biological statement. And so if China moved on Taiwan, would we have what it takes to jump in? Is that the right or wrong move? There's all these questions. And I, if you asked me, if it made me king of the world, it's not obvious to me I'd want to jump into it. It looks like such a, it seems to me, it's one of the things China's been gearing up to go for Taiwan. It's possible that there is nothing that's going to stop them. They're just waiting for the right moment. So if that's the case, let them in. I don't know.
So considering Biden's approval rating right now, Dave, could you see him, let's say, going to war to bolster it over either, let's say, Ukraine or Taiwan?
No, because I don't think he's calling the shots. And I'm not sure the people calling the shots give a damn about his approval rating. And, you know, I for all I know, he's playing Game Boy in the basement of the White House. And so Biden's this great Manchurian president where while we're talking about Biden being demented and dubious and making all these stupid statements, someone is doing stuff behind the scenes. And he might be the perfect patsy, the Oswald of the moment. So I don't think I think Biden's going to do it for his legacy. I don't think he's calling the shots. What I hear, the day before? I wrote a critique of his administration. If you look at his administration, it's really pathetic. It's a combination of box checking, which is code for woke appointments, and a bunch of neocons. And his Secretary of Energy a day or two ago was asked, how many barrels a day do we go through in oil? And she didn't have the numbers.
I saw that, yeah.
And I'm going, dude.
About 600 pools, right?
Yeah, about 600 pools. I said, dude, I'm not sure I would have had the numbers, but there sure as hell was a time in my life when I had the numbers, right? And so for the Secretary of Energy not to know, we've got a Secretary of Health who is transgender. She might be totally qualified, but you know that appointment was not made because she somehow surfaces the best candidate. You've got Merrick Garland, who sicked the FBI on soccer moms. You've got a woman nominated to be a controller of the currency that oversees the banking system, who is a commie from Cornell. And I'm not saying a commie like Rush Limbaugh would say a commie. I am talking card-carrying communist member. And she believes that the central bank should set asset prices. She believes that the central bank should get rid of private banks and the Federal Reserve should be the bank of everybody. That she is a communist from Kazakhstan. Who nominated her? Here's my theory, though. So you know the movie The Ring? Mm-hmm. Remember they get this VHS tape and they put it in, and this girl crawls out of the well. And next thing you know, they're being demonized by this wet-headed, creepy-looking girl. And they finally figure out that the way what they have to do to get rid of her is send the VHS to somebody else. Cornell has sent the VHS to Washington, D.C.
I like that analogy, Dave.
Yeah, it is kind of funny. I'm proud of that one.
So in that vein, how far do you think we are from getting a central bank digital currency in the U.S.?
Well, at some level, we already have one, right? Mm-hmm. So the question then becomes, what do you mean by a central bank digital currency? If you mean a blockchain digital currency, I got to figure we're pretty close. They want to get rid of cash. I've written about the war on cash in the past. Cash is a civil liberty. Cash allows you to stay anonymous at some level. Cash allows you to go to cash if they decide to totally nuke your bank account. They want to get rid of cash. They always talk about it's because bad guys use cash. Then around six paragraphs into the damn article, they say, oh, by the way, make monetary policy more flexible. And that's burying the lead. So they want to be able to set rates negative in bank accounts. And why? Because they're a bunch of commies. And that's a more metaphorical commie. But the central bankers do not believe in price discovery. They flat out are not capitalists by any. My definition of a capitalist is the cornerstone of capitalism is price discovery. The cornerstone is letting failures fail. The central bank, they believe that the price of capital should be set by a committee of idiots. Now, they wouldn't agree with the idiot part, but they would agree with the committee part. They think that if they look at the price of capital, imagine how demented you have to be to look at the price of capital being set by free markets and say, that price is wrong. Right?
The market doesn't know what it's talking about.
Yeah. And it would be really good for it. That's like taking someone's temperature and it's 98.6 to say, you know, we should sort of drill it down to 98.4. Right? It's just crazy. They don't believe in equilibration. They don't believe in letting corrections correct mistakes and none of that stuff. So as far as I'm concerned, they are feckless losers. And I think Powell should have walked from the Federal Reserve. As I said with Keith McCull, I said he got offered a lifeboat on the Titanic and he didn't take it. So at some point, we're going to lose faith in central bankers. Not just me and you, but everybody. But I think they're truly awful. And they're talking about climate change. What a bunch of assholes. Climate change. Central bankers do shit on monthly timescales. Climate change is at best a century timescale. Mm-hmm. They have nothing to do with climate change. They're babbling about it because they are yet looking for another reason to print goddamn money and to fuck around with the system. And I just, you know, take them behind the bar and shoot them, shallow grave them. I have no sympathy for them.
Dave, when we think about how they're, you know, making policy and the decisions that they're basing this policy on right now, how do you feel about the CPI numbers? And are we even, you know, close to seeing reality in that metric?
Well, we haven't for what, 45 years or something, 50 years. Apparently Johnson started, you know, sending the numbers back saying, make these better. And so, you know, you got the Chapwood Index showing high inflation. You've got John Williams' shadow stat showing high inflation. I just saw an article that said Thanksgiving is going to cost 14% more this year. So
maybe don't have turkey.
Yeah. In fact, you want the Federal Reserve of Bullocks, right? This is Minnesota, right? The Federal Reserve came out and tweeted that if you ate less turkey and ate the other stuff, that it would be much cheaper. I'm going, you guys just told us how to protect ourselves against your raging inflation. You really had the audacity to say that on Twitter? And they did. And so they're losers. And I think inflation, if I had to guess, I'd say I know nothing that's inflating at 6%. Mm-hmm. Nothing. And I didn't know things that are inflating at 300%. That is undoubtedly transitory. But wages are going to go up. Prices are going to go up. Everything's going to go up. I think we're inflating comfortably at 14%, which is what I said to Keith. I said 15%. Then the turkey story came out, says 14%. I'm okay with 14 over 15. I think that's a good estimate. You can't take 14% inflation for very long before you've been hurt very badly. And if you are getting no raise and you are suffering from 14% inflation, you can cut back on part of your spending, but you can't cut back on all of it. Because when my tax bill comes, I don't get to say, well, I'm only going to pay, you know, 86% of the tax bill because I'm cutting back. And so you guys are part of the problem. So you're not getting 14%. So I was involved in budgeting problems when the crisis came in 08, 09, and the university said, here, you got to cut 4%. You go, oh, yeah, of course we can cut 4%. Well, we were running pretty lean and mean. And what you quickly discover is there are vast piles of untouchable expenses. So that 4% ends up being 20% on something painful. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at where you could cut 14% out of your budget to make up for it, you would find it would be, it would look like 25 or 30% cuts wherever you find it. And then we are in a stagnant economy of the likes that we have not seen, at least for a very long time, decades, if not forever. I don't know. I think we're royally screwed.
And I've heard you talk before, Dave, about the planned obsolescence that is, you know, somewhat built into the hedonic adjustments that we see over time, you know, coming into that CPI. So tell us a bit more about that.
Well, the planned obsolescence is capitalists upping the revenue. So, you know, if you buy an iPhone, you know, you could use it longer than you end up being able to use it because it just becomes obsolete, right? And pretty soon, I had to get a new iPhone, which I bought used, but I had to update because Audible ceased to work, and I couldn't get it to work, and I have to have Audible. The thing that my pet peeve turns out to be accelerated depreciation. So I had a microwave break this year. The whole story started with when I broke a blender that was about 50 years old. I dropped it, this big, huge, heavy mother, right? The kind that if you drop it on your foot, you not only break the blender, but you'd be in the ER. And I broke it, and I realized that that blender, whenever they made it, was a lot of wealth. Then you buy a new one, it's this cheap, chintzy piece of shit with more buttons. So it's not only cheap coming from China, but it's considered even cheaper because they say, well, more buttons means we have to hedonically adjust it. Bottom line is, what's missing from that story is that that first blender gave probably 20-fold more, more consumable service than the new blender will, which means you have to adjust the inflationary effects by 20-fold. And then all of a sudden this year, I lost a microwave, a built-in microwave. It just stopped working. I don't know if it was the first one. I think it was. It was built in the wall. And if it was the first, it was 31 years old. It might be something less than that. I lost air conditioning this year, right? So it was in 1997. The guy told me, he says, yeah, this air conditioner was made in 97. I go, I got a good run out of that, right? 25 years. The ones that replace these won't last. And therefore, you have to put that into your inflation calculation. So inflation is really about the cost per use. My wife, for some reason, I don't know why, we had a cabin with a refrigerator in it. From about 1940, I was Googling, looking, saying, I think it's about 1940 based on what I'm seeing online. And so a 70-year-old fridge, 80-year-old fridge, replaced with a modern fridge, which I admit is more convenient. This thing had thick walls and a big lever thing that, you know, if your little kids are acting out, you just put them in there and suffocate them. But it still worked. Now, 80 years from now, there will be no functioning refrigerators that are 80 years old. Mm-hmm. So again, it's accelerated depreciation. When some plastic piece in your automatic windows in your car breaks, you don't replace the 50% plastic, you replace the unit for 500. I'm about to put in the second replacement car seat in my Impreza. Mm-hmm. Because it wears out right where you slide in the car, especially if you got a little too much fat on your ass and you're sliding in the car. But I've already replaced it once. Mm-hmm. I'm tempted to duct tape. I went looking for covers. I couldn't figure out what covers worked. But I shouldn't go through two car seats in an Impreza that I bought in 15. Mm-hmm. Right? The transmission went out on the Impreza. That would have been $8,000, except for it was a transmission problem. And so they extended, rather than replacing them all in a recall, they just extended the warranty 10 years. So I got a freebie.
No head gaskets yet?
No head gaskets yet. I like the Impreza. I don't mean to pick on them, but everything's decaying at a very... When our parents had a house full of appliances, when my parents did, those were capital goods. Those were wealth accumulated. So when you went from washing dishes in the sink to having a dishwasher, you had accumulated wealth. Now you've got a liability that in 5 to 7 years, you're going to have to replace again. Mm-hmm. So now you've got a house full of crap that's going to cost you money.
Dave, what are you listening to on Audible right now? You mentioned that you had to update your phone because of that. What are some of the you know, good books that you've read this year?
So, pitch for Audiophilia. A lot of people like podcasts. The problem is you have to keep finding podcasts to listen to. Mm-hmm. So if you have followers who follow your podcast, but you have to keep finding it again, right? And so I imagine people have automated this so they can see them all and they go boom, but they'll get an hour out of you and I. But an audiobook, you get about, you know, 10, 12, 15 hours. No decisions for 10, 12, 15 hours. Mm-hmm. I listen to nothing but nonfiction. The few fiction books I've listened to were not worth my time. And I want to come out of it smarter than I went into it, or at least more knowledgeable or more capable of molesting someone at a cocktail party. One time I was sitting there watching Jeopardy with my son, and they said, name one of the two kings of England whose name was used only once. Obviously, it's, you know, not King Henry. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there, my son's right next to me, and I go, King John, King Stephen. And that was the answer. And my son looked at me like I'd beamed down from Mars. Well, I just finished a whole audiobook on the kings and queens of England. Mm-hmm. And I happen to remember they both suck so badly that no one wanted those names again.
Yeah.
And so my goal is to retire and pay for my retirement playing Jeopardy. And I love audiobooks. And my wife asked me to go to the store. And it's like she's asked me to read for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And my wife, so I don't mind doing errands. If I used to, you know, if I had a consulting trip or something, you know, maybe in Connecticut, I'd fly. But that's a pain in the ass. Now I just put in an audiobook. I can do a whole book in the round trip. Mm-hmm. I have sleep disorders. And because of that, when I drive, I take Ritalin. So there's no zone better than popping in a Ritalin and turning on the audiobook and roaring down the highway. You're sitting there, your brain is being lit up, your receptors are going, and you're sitting there listening to, you know, Brett Weinstein banging away. So
it's a great way to find time to make productive use of your time, let's say driving
right.
or whatever.
That's yeah. right. I have a colleague who listens to my audiobook. I used to get CDs and she used to mooch them. Now it's Audible, but she used to listen to them while doing the dishes. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's what I don't do is I do listen to podcasts during time I could do something else, but that's nowhere near as good for me as when it's Audibles or nothing. Then mm-hmm. I go, oh, take the Audible.
Dave, I think we've covered a lot of the world's problems today. I really appreciate your time. Of course, you're best known for your Twitter feed at David B. Colum. Is there anything else you'd like to chat about before we wrap up here?
Well, I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Year in Review. Mm-hmm. And I'm running a little tight this year because the problems are particularly vexing. And it's a big ass thing that breaks into two pieces. I'm trying to figure out if I can't quite do what I want to do, if I break it into two pieces a week apart, which buys me the extra time, will that cause people to fall off the thing, read the first half and then never get back to the second half?
Well, maybe you need to bury the lead as you were talking about earlier. Number
well,
one.
Well, but and- then I could lose them though. Then I could. So my thought is that maybe what I do is I make sure they stitch together a week later. And probably a lot of readers don't pick it up for at least a week.
Well, I remember reading it last year and thinking to myself that, you know, it took me a little while to get through because it's a pretty dense, large article. So I think that would be fine.
Okay. You don't think I would have lost you at the halfway mark?
No, not me. I enjoyed reading it, but maybe I have a better context because you and I have spoken before.
Yeah. For those who don't know about it, it's called My Year in Review. So I should plug that. I've been doing it for about a dozen years now.
We'll make sure we post it when it comes out.
It's 200 pages typically. It's a big ass thing.
Yeah.
I try to make it funny. I try not to do what's called the expensive joke. The expensive joke is where the setup is too long. I get these long jokes sent to me by email and I go, that's too long. So I condense them to Twitter size or just as funny. The expensive joke you should avoid. And so if you're going to deliver a punchline, bam, it has to hit you right away. That you can't be making your reader read five lines before you get to the joke. Mm-hmm. And I love quotes. Smart guys come up with great wisdom condensed into this incredibly pithy phrase. My favorite of all, I think, is probably Voltaire, who said a pithy phrase is not wisdom. Which is so ironic. But I love quotes and I think it is funny and I go down dark rabbit holes. One this year I'm pondering, which I'm not confident I'm right on. Usually I'm pretty confident I'm right. I got one where I think the odds of me being right are, you know, maybe 20%, but it's a rabbit hole that I've got this need to go down it because I think, as part of the January 6th riots, which are going to be a big chunk. I think January 6th was a profound moment in U.S. history, but not for the reasons that everyone's talking about. So I'm going to bang on the January 6th riots in a very big way.
Well, Dave, I really look forward to reading it. And, you know, I really appreciate your time today as well.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Dave.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.